The Six Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM Portland.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, good morning and welcome to another edition of Investing Simplified in a little bit of a rainy, gray morning in Portland, Oregon. We do have a toll-free number out there if you are in the outlying areas, you want to give us a call. The number is 1-800-990-0750. That's 1-800-990-0750. And I got to say, I think they need to change that ad. We would be the seventh pillar of freedom because we're doing the show in Lars Larson's studio, so we really ought to be getting some credit for that, I think. I do want to introduce my co-host this morning, Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Carl.
I'm not sure we're quite up to the pillar level yet, but we'll try.
We're getting close. And Kevin Steggy with the Baker Coulson CPA Firm.
Good morning, gentlemen.
And you know what? I think we've got the corner pretty well taken care of with estate planning, with taxes, and investing.
All of those good things.
Yeah, I think we bring to the table pretty close to what some of those other guys bring to the table. Anyway, you're listening to Investing Simplified, where we talk about estate planning, we talk about taxes, and we talk about investing. But most important of all, we talk about what you, the listener, wants to talk about. And that's why we appreciate it when you give us a call and ask us a question. And as I always tell my clients and people that come in to talk to me, there is no foolish question when it comes to your money or your estate plan or your taxes. Because after all those things are owned by you. And so you're the person who's going to make the decision on those things. And knowledge is power. And we hope to provide a little knowledge here to you, the studio, listening to us in the audience. But here's the thing I want to say. I got an email this week from one of my clients, very concerned. She lives in Oregon, used to live in California. Excuse me, and is thinking about, because of the Oregon estate tax, thinking about leaving the state. And I know we've talked about this before.
I've had a number of clients actually who've come in and expressed that at least concern, if not the thought or intent to move. Some would say they would prefer to move to Washington. The dilemma is that in California there is no estate tax, so you don't worry about it. Unless you're over the 5.34 million that the federals allow you. But in Oregon, you have $1 million exemption. So anything over $1 million is vulnerable to the Oregon inheritance tax. Whereas in Washington, it's $2 million. So theoretically, if you plan correctly, under Oregon law, you and your husband or wife can transfer up to $2 million tax-free to your heirs. And under Washington law, you could transfer $4 million. But if you're over that, or if you're an individual and you're over the $1 million or $2 million, then you have some choices to make. But nonetheless, it's an issue that people don't like to face. Your client gave us this article, I think, right?
She actually, a friend of hers in California who's trying to get her to move to California, basically got a hold of her and said, you ought to read this out of the Times. This article talks about why some states are moving to loosen their estate taxes because they're finding out that high-earning people, high-net-worth people, unless they're tied up in land in that state, if their money's in other investments, they're leaving the state. And so the state's not only losing the estate tax, The state's losing the income tax revenue and the spending revenue of these very wealthy people.
Absolutely. And ironically, there's only about, I don't know, 12, 15, 16 states in the United States that still have an inheritance tax, an individual state inheritance tax. And there are several of those. I know that I think New York is contemplating the possibility of getting rid of theirs, and maybe New Jersey really should. New Jersey is probably the most onerous inheritance tax because their limit is only $675,000, which, you know, dates back to 1986, I think.
Carl, we remember when that was the federal estate
tax. It was a federal
tax.
Standard. That's exactly yes. Right. And so it's interesting how that all of that works. And so they're looking at it because a lot of times the states are finding also that, you know, there are relatively few people who have that much money that they're going to be taxed under the inheritance tax. But they do, like you say, they do add to the economy. They buy stuff, they have income, but all those things.
That's true. But, you know, the majority of taxes are paid by the upper 10-20% of wealthy people in America. And so the states really need to take note. And, you know, if you're chasing these people out of your state, you know, even their retirement income that they would be receiving, you know, they're taking it to another state, possibly to a state that has no income tax. They're taking their estate to an estate that doesn't have to a state that doesn't have an estate tax.
Right.
So it's you know, it's no small thing to the people in the upper 10-15% of income earners.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the issue there is how much does the state gain versus how much does it lose? And many of the states are saying, well, you know, we're not really losing that much by the inheritance tax, but we are losing a lot by having people stay away from us or move away from us. Especially, I think, in states like Oregon, where it tends to be an attractive place for people to move if they've been living in a, you know, big urban area or something. They feel like that they want to come to a you know, an environmentally pretty place and that sort of thing. Weather's fairly nice here. Mm-hmm. So I think it can be a problem. I know that there are some consideration to that. In 2013, there were a number of bills, I think, in the Oregon legislature that proposed basically doing away with it, or you know, connecting it with the federal government. But those didn't pass, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the silly thing is that, you know, there's a lot of people, and there's going to be a lot of baby boomers who are going to be getting over the $1 million threshold. And the silly thing is for the most part, with just a little bit of planning, some astute planning from gentlemen such as yourself, Carl and Chuck, you can escape the inheritance tax in Oregon if you set things up right for most people. And if you look at Oregon's revenues from the inheritance tax, it's not that big.
Exactly.
And it's because people have put plans in place, and you know, either a gifting plan, you've got the AB Trust. Oregon has this thing called the Oregon Special Marital Property Election Trust.
Which is equivalent to what they call the Q-tip Trust, or the Qualified Terminal Interest Property Trust. Or, you know, sounds like an earwax thing.
the thing that amazes me about the short-sightedness of the government about that is, you collect the estate tax one time, you got to die. Somebody's going to be around 30, 40 years paying you 10%, and your estate tax is only above $1 million at 20 to 25%, and you're really more concerned about getting that than the ongoing revenue every year for maybe 30 or 40 years. It's not a logical move. Of course, nothing about government is logical, but if you think about dollars and cents, I think it would pay the state to not have an estate tax, or maybe raise the estate tax to keep those high earners in the state paying them the 9% or 10% whatever they're paying them tax.
You know, because actually we've had, as you mentioned, Kevin, the baby boomers have a lot of people, quite frankly, who have over $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds like an awful lot, but you know, if you have a couple of rental properties and a retirement and some life insurance, it's easy to get over $1 million.
Well, and the baby boomers are the ones, the first generation to really inherit a lot of wealth from their parents.
Right.
And you know, just demographically, the female baby boomers are going to be receiving the largest transfer of wealth just about in the, you know, the history of the world, because, you know, just demographically, they live longer than their husbands, and they're going to be in control of a lot of wealth, and they're the ones who are going to be making the final decisions on where a lot of this should go. So,
oh, absolutely. We have this article, and it pretty much makes the point that there are some good reasons maybe to think about, you know, doing something about estate taxes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I did was I went to the Oregon State Legislature website and kind of casually went through all of the bills that are before the 2014 session, and there wasn't any that changed the estate tax. So mm-hmm. So that doesn't look like they're seeing it as a serious problem. Although I you know, it's interesting because I think the reason is that they don't. It's real. There's a bunch of budget issues, of course, there always is, and they always want to have as much revenue as they can, but they don't like to raise taxes. They hate raising taxes. They just don't like it because it gets them unelected. And so it's very easy to not do anything and still have the tax rather than, you know, cut the tax, even though there may not be that big of an effect. But on the other hand, they would be gaining, I think, some tax revenues by preserving the higher yeah. wealth people.
Yeah. Well, I just am curious, someone like Phil Knight, is he going to stay around Oregon here, or is he going to find a home in California or something? I mean,
he has homes in California. I mean, he's one of the biggest donors to Stanford University.
Yeah.
He has a degree from Stanford and Oregon.
And to think that he would sit back and just give roughly 16% of his estate to Oregon when he would pass away, you know, barring all of the complicated, you know, structures that he has in place.
Well, you know, the amazing thing is you look at, look at Bill Gates. He lives in Seattle, you know, in the state of Washington.
Right.
And but Bill Gates' estate, as I remember looking at it from some estate planning things came out, that because Bill Gates has been very vocal about the federal estate tax, he thinks that's a good thing. And one of the reasons he does is because he's given like $40 billion away, and his heirs are going to pay no estate tax because of the 50% exemption you get when you give away your estate up to 50%. They're basically going to – he's leaving his kids all $10 million each, and virtually his estate is going to be nothing because he's going to give it all away. So, if you have – when you reach a point of being a billionaire status, the federal estate tax really probably doesn't come into play because you're going to be given so much away that you get that exclusion on the gift up to 50%. You eliminate a lot of the estate tax, and it's like Warren Buffett. He's done the same thing. I think he's given each kid $1 billion, but then all the rest goes to charity. So if you compare that to the average person can't do that.
Yeah. Well, he's, you know, it's probably not a straight out gift. He'd be paying a lot of tax up front on that. Yeah. So it's probably in trusts and that type
of thing. Well, it's at death.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the estate's given it.
I see.
Yeah. And so that way they get an exemption for it. But, the average person out there who's building an estate or maybe inherited some funds or built a business who's got a $3 to $5 million estate in Oregon, you'd have to take a good look at that and say, hey, I can move to California or I can move to Washington. Let's see, if I move to Washington, I got no income tax, no state income tax, setting up proper trust. I have no estate tax, unless I do get above that, you know, the $5 million. But so you got no estate tax, so why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, I know the powers that be down in Oregon they're watching this fairly closely because it is an impact on them. And you know, when somebody leaves the state of Oregon and you know they've had, say, Oregon property, you sell that, and, you know, or you know, you move to a different state and stuff, you know, they're still wanting their fingers on some of those assets. So it's, I think it's a painting that is still being painted.
Yeah, I think we can't really necessarily anticipate what the effect would be, but I think it's certainly a real issue because I've had clients who have exactly said that. And I've had some clients who have moved to Washington. They said, well, you know, I'm retired now. I'm not working here anymore. I paid my last income tax to the state of Oregon. And by the way, I'm taking my $3 million estate and I'm moving over to Vancouver or Camas or wherever they go.
You really can't blame them. I mean,
no.
It's common sense. And I, you know, the thing is, the client wanted to know if there was any current proposals or any new efforts in the state to do away with the estate tax or change it.
Well, there aren't any bills introduced that I know of, but I know that there are a number of people who have proposed that before, and I wouldn't at all be surprised to see it come up again. Nobody seems to it just hasn't caught any traction yet. It's not a very exciting subject for most people. You don't really worry about it all that much, but. But, you know, it's a policy matter, and it affects a lot more people than I think most people realize because of the, like you said, the baby boomer issue, that, and because our exemption amount is so low that, there are a lot more people who actually do have that. And it's a nasty surprise, by the way, when people, you know, come over the limit and they don't realize they did it because, for example, if you've, you know, I've seen this happen where somebody ends up with, and they were believing that they were, you know, under $1 million. They knew about it, but they believed that they were under $1 million. And then later, 4 or 5 years later, both of them die. I mean, one of them dies, and then there's no tax. So they don't think about it. They're not worried about it. And then the next thing you know, they're at $1.3 million. Well, all of a sudden, you know, they've got a $75,000 to $100,000, you know, inheritance tax. Now, obviously, they're deceased, so they don't worry about it, but their heirs sure are. And if that property is in real property instead of, you know, liquid assets, then they have a problem paying it. So,
well, I don't know how the state keeps track of, you know, revenue on that basis, but I know at least two business owners who have moved their business to from Oregon to Vancouver, mm-hmm. or Camas, mm-hmm. and sold their property. Their buildings in Portland, mm-hmm. turned around, bought another one, are generating anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million a year in tax revenue, which now they're giving to the state of Washington. The state of Oregon lost. The state of Oregon lost their estate taxes, and that's lost revenue the state's never getting back.
Well, not only that, they lost the income from the business and the people who work there.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And the employment taxes.
The employees and everything are now in Washington. They're not paying Oregon taxes. So Oregon lost, you know, 4 or 5 employees and an employer who has a fair amount of income tax they were paying and estate tax that now they don't have an estate tax.
Right.
Well, you know, this scenario plays itself out in so many different areas of tax law. You probably heard the testimony from Caterpillar before Congress about them taking their profits, just like Apple had done, and a number of other huge corporations keeping their profits out of the U.S. and taxed in a lower jurisdiction. So, I mean, this issue, I mean, covers a lot of different circles, a lot of different tax situations, and if it's the laws that are in effect at the time, you know, it's just a loophole, I guess you could call it, it's not fraudulent. Is it wrong to take advantage of those things? Probably not. It's you know, the way it's structured. And
I believe there's a very famous court ruling by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it says that you absolutely have a right to minimize your tax within the law, basically.
Within the law, as long as you're doing it legally.
And many companies and individuals have done exactly that. And in fact, I guess, if you've got a corporate taxpayer, you know, we now know, especially since Citizens United and this most recent thing, that at least for most purposes, corporations are considered as individuals, so they have that same right. In other words, they have the same right as the individual does to minimize their taxes. So,
speaking about taxes, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with the tax investigator because we've been talking about estate taxes, and we're going to shift it a little bit and have Kevin. We're so blessed to have him here during tax season because Carl and I have been trying to keep him awake, waking him up, get him going here because
that's right.
He's had a tough week. But we'll be right back with the tax investigator.
We Investing Simplified.
Let's face it, the rules of retirement have changed. What we were told to do just a few years ago now seems like a pipe dream. Hi, this is Michael Burnett for Chuck Price, owner of Price Financial Group Wealth Management. You know the drill. Be a loyal employee. You'll get a pension. Your home will be worth 10 to 20 times what you paid for it when you retire. So how's that working for you? Call Chuck Price right now. He's located right here in Portland. Featured expert on Investing Simplified on AM 970. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or close to retiring, and he focuses on protection of principal and tax strategies to minimize your taxes. Call right now and get Chuck's retirement report. It's packed full of information on generating more income during retirement, how to leave more to your heirs, and so much more. 503-253-3000. Chuck Price, Price Financial Group Wealth Management, on the web at pfgwm.com. Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified, 503-417-7626. If you've been working on your taxes or you want something clarified on your taxes, definitely give us a call and we'll see what we can do. Well, today on the Tax Investigator, just one brief news item to update you on that we've talked about before here. The Supreme Court finally came down with a ruling on whether severance payments are subject to FICA taxes or not. And now maybe you remember the issue. Severance payments have been treated as wages and they're subject to the Social Security, Medicare taxes that we all pay just like normal wages. But there was a case that said, hey, this really isn't wages. You're not working for severance payments. This is more along the lines of unemployment. And of course, when you receive unemployment from the state, it's not subject to all those taxes. So the Supreme Court basically dug into the definition of wages all the way back to the 60s, I think it was, or something along those lines. And they came back and, of course, they said it is subject to Social Security, Medicare taxes. So we have said before, the eagle screams again. The government will get their share.
The wages of sin.
That's right. Yep. That's right. All right. So today, you know, Carl, in past shows, you've dropped some pretty heavy words on us. In the last couple of weeks, you've used the word escheat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. You're talking about his legalese.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And that'll cost you $50.
Okay. Very true. And I know, and I'm holding you to this, you have used the word inure.
Yes, I have.
Yes, you have. And that starts with an I, not
an M. Is that kind of like manure?
It starts with an I, not an M.
When I say it, it is, yeah.
That's right. So today I'm going to do my best Carl impersonation, okay. And we are going to talk about decanting.
Ooh.
Decanting your trust.
Okay.
Yes. And
that just doesn't sound good, Kevin.
You are right.
That doesn't sound good.
Anytime you are having to decant your trust, you better hire your attorney.
Sure sounds like pouring it out of a bottle, doesn't it?
Oh,
That's
a good picture. So basically, decanting your trust is when you have set up an irrevocable trust and you have transferred assets from your estate for whatever purpose into a trust for whatever beneficiary reason that you have, circumstances in life may change on you. And I think they do for all of us. There could be marriages, there could be deaths, there can be births, there can be all sorts of life's events that change things. And you have an irrevocable trust that you no longer think you like how it is to be administered.
Gee, Carl, we've been there, haven't we?
We've been there, yeah.
I remember this one real well.
That's right. So decanting your trust is the process in some states that allows you to actually change the terms of your irrevocable trust. and allows you to basically, in general, sets up a new trust where you take the assets, you move them into the a new trust, and I'm greatly simplifying this.
Is it tax-free exchange?
Well, you're stealing my thunder.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
That's right. So, and there's only 21 states that have provisions to do that. But just because you can legally do something, just because you have the legal capacity to do something, doesn't mean that the tax implications aren't punitive or different, such as you can take out an early distribution from your retirement plan, but you all know that there's penalties to that. And so, in decanting your trust, the IRS has been studying this issue. They've been addressing it with interested parties and getting comments. And I know the AICPA has been chiming in to them on that. And the verdict is that they are undecided at this point. So that is that's a difficult thing. But you can understand what the issues are. Basically, you've taken something that you've put an asset into a trust for such and such beneficiary. It's irrevocable, and you've possibly paid gift tax, or at least filed a gift tax return on this transaction, and now you're going and saying, hey, I want a different beneficiary. I want different assets in there, although a lot of times you can add assets, but maybe you want to change assets. So there's a number of different tax implications that could happen. My general thought is that this isn't going to be a favorable thing tax-wise, although they will probably at least take the steps of keeping it simple where you don't actually have to set up a new trust in terms of getting in a tax ID number, filing two tax years, passing a K-1 from one trust to your other trust, so on and so forth. I mean, that would just be messy.
Yeah, actually, last year I attended the Washington State Bars. They have an annual sort of a estate planning boot camp or something they might call it. It's 2 days long. And anyway, one of the speakers spoke for about an hour on decanting, and, you know, three or four of us were awake at the end of the presentation. But anyway,
you were one of them.
I was one of them. And so the thing is that the provisions that allow you to do this, and this decanting, it's interesting that because it really what they're talking about is sort of indirectly amending an irrevocable trust when you can't do it directly in a way, but it's fairly limited in the sense that my recollection is that, you know, that it depends on what the purpose is. You know, if it is really something that goes really against the purpose of the original trust, that you probably aren't going to get to be able to do that. I mean, like, for example, you know, it's the old, you know, Candy the caregiver thing. You know, you know, grandpa's got the trust and he says, oh, wait a minute. I want it to go to Candy, not that, you know, that terrible little, you know, son-in-law that I had, or that, you know, whatever. And my other person that I don't like either. And anyway, you know, that kind of thing probably isn't going to fly. And I think it's going to, and again, not many people really have irrevocable trusts except the credit shelter trusts that are set up at the time that the first spouse does.
Those are the typical ones, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that brings a new meaning to the word irrevocable, doesn't it?
It does. Irrevocable until you can
mostly
revoke it. Yeah,
mostly
yeah.
Irrevocable.
Mostly irrevocable, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I just wonder, from an estate tax planning standpoint, when you set up the irrevocable trust to move it out, move those assets so they're never taxed again for estate tax purposes, does that bring those assets back into a taxable estate?
Good question. I have no idea.
That's part of the things that have to be looked at. So I think if you change the term significantly enough and you have incidents of ownership of the asset again, I would think that the IRS is going to...
Well, yeah, I would think the IRS would say, well, wait a minute, you've changed the identity. You know, you created this trust, this particular trust, and it was an irrevocable trust, and now you poured it into a new trust, and you've got a new number, and you've changed the term. So that's a new trust. So whatever applied to the old trust no longer applies to this one. So guess what? You know,
exactly.
Well, that could be very costly.
Yeah, it could.
Could be very costly. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back with Carl's comments. You're listening to Investing Simplified. If you want to give us a call, you can call 1-800-990-0750. That's 800-990-0750. Or locally, 503-417-7626. You're listening to Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepsen.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepsen, and this is Carl's comment. Well, you can also reach us here at 800-990-0750, or is it 0950? 750. I got it right. There you go. 800-990-0750 is our toll-free number. Well, Carl's comments is a time when I talk about something that has come to my attention in the last week or so. And one of the things that I'm privileged to do is to work with the married couples who've been married a long time and some not so long. But oftentimes, you know, I'll send them some information when they're getting ready to come in to visit me. I'll send them a questionnaire and they'll fill it out. But sometimes they haven't thought of some other questions that I wish that they would ask themselves before they come to the estate planning meeting, because it's kind of awkward sometimes when you find out the answers to these questions at the first time when you're in the meeting with the lawyer. And so I have 10 questions that you should discuss with your spouse before you come to the estate planning lawyer. And number one is, do you want your spouse to have total control over the assets after you die? That's a real interesting question. There are many, many answers to that. None of them are wrong, but it is something you ought to, it's partly a philosophical question, and it might end up being partly a tax question as well. But in general, do you want them to have as much control as they can or not? And that varies a lot, and there may be a lot of different reasons why you wouldn't or you do.
That probably is a good one to talk about beforehand, because if you say no and the other spouse whips their head around and says, what, you don't trust me with the assets?
Could be a little problem.
And, you know, and the wife says, you're going to die first anyway. You're the guy. You know, I mean, what do you mean I don't get to use the money? I mean, seriously, that's not, you know, or you can see that look. You know the husband's arm kind of withers up, and you go, uh-oh, we're in trouble here, send him to the divorce department. But, no, I'm kidding. Actually, but I have seen it happen occasionally. But number two, do you want your spouse to be required to maintain the same disposition of property after you die? In other words, if you have this set up, so, you know, when you have to agree on who you're going to give your stuff to after you die. Well, that may or may not be an easy question, because, you know, there may be blended families, there may be differences of opinion about, you know, this, that, or the other thing. So it's something you ought to think about. What happens if you die, and do you want your spouse to be required to have the same disposition provisions or distribution provisions as you do when, you know, right now? Or sometimes you may have yes for some of the property and no for some of the property. You don't necessarily have to have it all the same way. But it's a question that you need to ask. And, you know, how do I really want this to work? It kind of goes back to number one, which is, how much control do you want to give to the surviving spouse? Or do you want to say, this is how we're going to do it no matter what? There's pluses and minuses to that, because if you lock it in, you might have to try to decant the trust at the end of the day, which we all know is challenging. On the other hand, so I like to see some people put in some flexibility so that they can work with each other and hopefully be people of goodwill. So number three, how do you feel about your spouse remarrying? Same kind of question. Do they get to, if they go and meet Paul the pool boy, do you really want him, you know, driving around in your Porsche? I mean, I don't know. I kind of don't think I'd like it very well. Maybe. I don't know. Just a thought. Maybe you don't care. Number four. This was a hard one. How do you feel about your spouse's children? Really, honestly. If you have complete control, then that means that the surviving spouse has the ability to distribute the money directly to her children and maybe not yours if you lived in a blended family. I know that's kind of harsh, but nonetheless, that's a reality that happens all the time when steps are not taken to prevent it. So,
well, you know, Carl, you just said that. It made me think that it's not always what you say, but how you say it.
Absolutely.
And asking that question about asking, the husband, what he thinks about Paul the pool boy driving around in his Porsche. But if you ask the wife how she feels about Candy, the caregiver,
yeah,
living in her house, you get a whole different reaction.
Exactly my point. that's why I'm suggesting they discuss these things before they.
Absolutely.
I hate to be. I like to be an estate planning lawyer, not a referee or
not
mediator.
A family counselor.
So number five. Here's the other. The number four was, how do you feel about your spouse's children? Now here's the other one. Number five. How do you think they feel about you, really? And this is a real common problem. It is not uncommon where, over the years, one spouse or the other has developed a very good relationship with the other spouse's children. And then it seems like when mom or dad dies, those children all of a sudden look at stepmom as the evil stepmom, and they like sort of emotionally disinherit her from everything in the world. And believe it or not, those moms or those dads really take it hard. So if you're cozying up to, stepmom just because in respect of your dad or vice versa, maybe you ought to think about doing that after mom or dad dies, because, keep the respect if that's what you have there. So anyway, but nonetheless, that's the thing. And it can be real problematic, too, because if the new stepmom has control and the stepchildren, basically diss her then or him, then he or she can diss them right out of the will, maybe. Maybe if there's a practical reason for retaining your respect, it might be a good thought. Nonetheless. So number six, and this is kind of dovetails into that. It says, would you punish your children or your stepchildren financially if they don't attend to you after, your spouse dies? Same question. So I won't beleaguer that one. And number seven, if you both have children by prior marriage, should they all share equally, that is, each child gets the same amount, or should it be 50% to your children and 50% to his children or your spouse's children or some other thing? That often is a real big issue that comes up. You've got maybe three kids on one side and two kids on the other. The one with three kids wants them to get 50-50. The one with, two wants to get them all equal shares, So that's an awkward question because, you have this moment of recognition when the spouses look at each other and they go, ooh, I'm not sure about that. And at which time I say, why don't you think about that and let me know before we finish this up. So anyway, that's another one. Number eight, do you want to give all the money to your kids at one time, or do you want to put it in some kind of restrictive trust? That's an interesting question, too. Do you want all the kids to be treated the same? Do you want one child, the prodigal child, to have to wait till they're, 92 to get the money? Or do you want to give it to them all at one time and just say, we're going to be dead, bygones be bygones? That's all depends on your philosophy and your own personal feelings about how things ought to be done. But it is a question that you should discuss with your spouse, because otherwise, you can have some disparity in how to do it. And then it makes it awkward. I mean, quite frankly, it does make it awkward when when one of these disputes comes up and you're kind of going, ooh, gee, well, I appreciate that, but, you know, we got to, you know, if you're at odds, you know, we have a problem. You know, Houston, we have a problem. It's kind of a real problem. So anyway, number nine, do you agree on who ought to be the personal representative or the trustee? Ah, now here's another question. You know, you've got children on both sides, you know, and you want one of them to be the trustee? You know, do you want stepchild to be your child's, you know, trustee or vice versa? Or, I don't know. Good question. One that I don't have an answer to. If you really can't get to the issue where you're both comfortable with whatever choice you have, then it's time for a professional fiduciary, as far as I'm concerned. But that has some issues of its own. And finally, number 10, basically this dovetails with that. Do you really want one of your children to be the trustee? You know, a lot of times that's not a good choice. And again, we talked here a few weeks ago about, you know, who should be a trustee and what things you should look for. And so, you know, we'll talk about that again sometime. But right now, I just want to point out that sometimes the trustee isn't always best suited. You know, the child isn't the best suited person for that for a variety of reasons. A lot of times because it sort of punishes that child who's the trustee. They end up having to put up with all the flack that they get from the other siblings.
It's not an easy job.
It's not an easy job. And so it's one of those things you need to consider a lot of things. You know, are they capable of it? Do they have the skills to do it? Do they have the time to do it? And do they have the emotional stability to deal with the flack that they're going to get? And, you know, do they want to do it? So good thoughts anyway. So those are my 10 points on questions that you should discuss with your spouse before you come to your estate planning lawyer.
And does each spouse need to bring their own attorney when they go to their estate planning attorney?
Hopefully not.
Okay. You know, that would be no. That's the whole point is that we're trying to avoid that. You know, so
You don't want to end up being with a divorce attorney. You want an estate planning attorney.
Those questions are to be answered honestly and fairly within the confines of their own home.
Well,
so.
And a lot of these questions, you know, the answers are pretty apparent to people in their situations, and a lot of times they're not. You know, you could have just the perfect child to be the trustee, and you know they're the ones who the other ones look up to and will listen to, and it just works out. Maybe you've got good family harmony, and you don't have a problem in that regard, but that's not always the case.
That's absolutely true. You know, I love that when they come in, they say, "Oh, and both." You know, spouses are just, yep, that's the best person to be the trustee because, you know, great, that's wonderful. It's the, you know, it's the ones when they're, I don't know about that, you know, then you've got to think about it carefully. So you bet. So
yeah, absolutely. I think we got a call here. We got a question on the phone. Looks like Jerry has a tax question. Jerry, are you there?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. I got a S corporation and, it's a, I spun off most of the business. I'm retired, or semi-retiring, and I got the first payment in the mail. So I need to know how it gets handled on the S corporation.
I see. Did you sell assets? Did you actually sell the S corp stock?
It'd be like. A client list.
Okay, a client list, and you still have the S corp open? Is that correct?
Yeah, because I still do other little things.
Okay, and is it? So it sounds to me like the S corp sold the client list on an installment sale. Basically, in that case, you know, the amount of principal amount of payment that you receive in the current year, you kind of figure the gain on the whole sale, and then in an installment sale, you just report your share of the interest income and then your portion of the gain for this year. It goes on your S-Corp, and the S-Corp is probably going to pass that out to you. There's a number of, I got just a bunch of questions on the top of my head, all of which we should probably don't have time to address here, but there are some sophisticated tax planning strategies with this. In other words, you know, You sold the client list, but maybe there's goodwill. Is this personal goodwill or is this S-Corp goodwill, and it kind of makes a difference in how that's treated. It depends on what tax bracket you're in. So there are some planning opportunities even after the fact here to look at.
Okay. So we talked to a tax person.
I would say in this situation, you probably should have somebody take a look at the S corp. You know, kind of look at the numbers. You know, if we're you know talking $50,000, it's probably not that big a deal. Just run it through the S corp and be done with it. But if you know if it's a you know $500,000 sale of a client list, there's a number of things to look at.
You know, Kevin, from a tax standpoint, since he's received the first check.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean it's a done deal, or can he go back now and maybe restructure this to be more tax advantage to him?
Well, it's pretty well a done deal, and you know, depending on how the documents are signed, you know, was it the S corp that sold the asset, or was it him personally? I mean, all of those things have to be looked at. How the deal was structured by the attorneys, or you know, what the documents are. Those are really going to kind of be the game plan.
And if it goes on the S, if it's run through the S corp, it seems like there was a thing on a Schedule E that gets filled out where there's passive and non-passive income. Would this be split out into passive income because you're not actually doing anything?
This is probably going to be capital gain coming to you from the sale of the client list, and so it's just going to be capital gain, which. Isn't going to be classified as passive or non-passive. Probably, it's probably just going to come through as capital gain and go on your 4797 on your personal return form 4797, and hopefully get capital gain tax rates for you on your personal return.
So is that kind of like if there was interest that ran through the corporation, it would come on the K-1 then.
That's exactly right. Yes.
Okay.
Now, if you're getting interest on the payment, though, you know, they owe you so much money, and you're paying they're paying interest on that, and you're getting a portion of interest on each payment. The interest is taxed differently, though. I think
it is. The interest will get passed through as interest. The gain will get passed through as hopefully capital gain.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Great. Good
Thank
question,
you.
Jerry. Thank you. Good question.
Very good question.
Yeah. You know. There's all kinds of things that happen on these kind of things, and something he said made me think about something you and I have talked about. When a person sets up and they're doing gifts, there's a gift form that you file with your taxes, even though you don't have to report it. What is that form that people? Because I've had several people ask me about they're going to do a gift. And they want to give a gift to one of their kids, or mm-hmm. they want to give a gift to somebody. And when you do that, even though it's not, you don't have to report it for tax purposes, there's a form that you should file.
Well, for tax purposes, you file the form 709, which if you give a gift over $14,000, you report the person's name, address, social security number, and what you gave them.
But what if you give it to them under the lifetime exemption? Say, you know, I'm going to give you $5 million.
That would be the form.
Okay.
Form 709,
okay.
where you would do that. If you give under the $14,000 per year, you know, you should write out a statement to show your intent. But otherwise, the 709 is pretty straightforward. It's literally you just put the name, address, social security number, and the valuation of the gift. If it's cash, it's easy. If it's something else that needs an appraisal, that's a little harder. Other than that, the 709 reports it and properly.
And what happens if you don't file that form?
Then there are some issues with that. Your gift still has occurred, but I believe it still leaves the window open for the IRS to come back and challenge that gift because you haven't reported it to them.
Right, and I suppose that any of the bad stuff regarding that would date back to the date of the gift if you hadn't reported it.
That's exactly right, especially if you're giving a small business stock or something like this that has a valuation that you've maybe discounted, you want to file that gift tax return so that you've given notice to the IRS and they have a set amount of time to challenge that valuation. Once that time is gone, then your gift is final. The valuation is final. But if you never file it, they've got an unlimited amount of time to challenge it.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back with a wrap-up of the show. You're listening to Investing Simplified. We'll come back with the Knowledge Trust.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had $1 million.
If you had a million dollars, you better pick up that phone and give us a quick call. We may have some ideas for you. Again, we're at that time of the show where it's probably a little late to be calling in now because we're going to be running out of time. And kind of a wrap-up today, I didn't give a stock report, but I will tell you that the market was down a little bit at the end of the week. And yes, the Dow Jones actually was down 159 for the week, but actually up for the total week. And the S&P was down also, but up for the week. So the market continues to be up and down, roller coaster like we think it's going to be and continue being. And you want to just be watching the fluctuations of the market and what the trend is. We still don't think, from Harry Dent stuff, and you know, we have Harry Dent on the show. And again, if you call in the show, and you, I should have mentioned this at the start of the show, but next week, if you call in the show, we will give you a free copy of Harry Dent's book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014 and 2019. And so in the third Saturday of the month, we have Harry Dent on the show, or Rodney Johnson, his co-editor. And you can also go on my website and listen to our past shows. And I know the last time Carl and I had Harry on the show, he went for about 40 straight minutes. I don't think he breathed more than once or twice. But it's quite a play, and I highly recommend, if you have not heard him, you ought to go to my website and click on that show. Last month, the third Saturday, and we had Harry Dent on there, and so it's worth the listen to, isn't it, Carl?
It is, and you know, he is he brings together so many factors that, you know, a lot of times I'm thinking, I never thought of that as affecting the economy, but you know, he's right. I mean, it makes sense a lot of times because but it's just that the economy is so incredibly complicated that. You know, hearing him talk about it in a kind of a global way is pretty interesting.
Well, you know, one of the things he talks about in our demographic class is one of the things he talks about is why is it important to you as an investor to know at what age the average person buys the most potato chips they're ever going to buy in their lifetime? And it's age 43. And it's not because you're 43. It's because you probably have teenage kids at home. And that's the real clue right there. And of course, your spending habits at 43, if you're buying potato chips, and if you knew a very large segment of the population was going to be turning 43, you might want to invest in somebody like Frito-Lay or somebody who makes potato chips. Might not be a bad deal, particularly if you saw that demographic trend going over a 4 to 6 year period. You'd know you're going to have a pretty good run-up on that, and probably soda, too. If people buy chips, they usually buy pop.
And if you're buying chips and pop, you might as well buy healthcare stocks, too.
And also
for 20 years down the road,
And then you got to get some big screen TVs in there too at the same time.
And sofas. Absolutely, I mean, yeah. All these things kind of go together.
Because whether you're sick or eating chips, you're going to be in front of the TV.
Well, you
right?
you saw Gary Player's interview with John Canzano here, where Gary Player blasted America for what we're doing to our kids. And he basically said we're the fattest, laziest country out there, and we've got so much available to us, and we're not, and we're letting ourselves slide into the abyss with our health. So that's an interesting take from Gary Player. Anyway, that was on John Canzano.
It's interesting. Yeah. Gary Player, I remember way back when, because he hasn't been on the tour for many years.
Yeah.
But I remember when he was on the tour, he was one of the very first guys that had an active weightlifting program along with golf.
He was the first guy to really say physical fitness, golf is a sport.
Mm-hmm.
And, for many, many years when I was growing up, nobody considered golf a sport.
Right. Right.
And until I actually played it, I found out how tough it really is. It is a very tough sport. But if you're going to play that every day, day in and day out, you better be in shape.
Absolutely.
And the better golfers, of course, Tiger Woods is one that everybody thinks of too. And except he's had the physical problems, so he's probably. I don't think he's going to catch Jack, but I think it's going to be pretty tough unless he can get healthy real quick once you hit 40 in golf.
Well, and back injuries are probably the most common thing among golfers because every chiropractor and every people that work on backs. That I've known say, that's not the best activity for bad backs.
Well, having had back problems, I can certainly agree with that. Well, listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back next Saturday. Don't forget to get up early Saturday morning, get that hot cup of coffee, and turn on Investing Simplified. Carl, how does somebody get a hold of you?
Telephone number is 503-255-8795 and warrenallen.com.
Kevin?
503-666-5569, and we're at BakerColson.com.
And you get a hold of me on the web at PFGWM.com or 503-253-3000, conveniently located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103 in the Price Finance Group building. And thank you very much, and we'll talk to you next week.
Price Financial Group, wealth.